Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, in school he got punished for speaking his native language, but after America entered World War II, it was a different story. Bet you've never heard this before. You'll hear this Navajo code talker sing and tell his story today at 1 on News Talk 580 1059, brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. Now, you're not going to hear them call themselves that, but that humility is part of what makes them all the more admirable. I'm talking, of course, about the men and women who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. And each time on Hometown Heroes, we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. The goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so the price that's been paid for our freedom is not something we forget. And of course, along the way, the hope is that we're educated, we're entertained, and perhaps even inspired by just how much these veterans love our country. It is, of course, Father's Day weekend, and in thinking a little bit about that, it hit me that in many ways, listening to this show can feel like Father's Day weekend every weekend. I know we've had our fair share of female veterans on the program over the years, but of course it's mostly men. That's the majority of the folks who have served our country. And I've learned over the years that most of the people listening to Hometown Heroes are in the same position that I'm in. So many of us would not be here. We would have never been born if our fathers or our grandfathers hadn't made it safely home from war. I've also learned through your feedback that a lot of our listeners had parents or grandparents who served in World War II, but never talked about those experiences. So in a way, hearing the veterans share their stories here helps you learn a little more about what your dad or uncle or grandpa might have gone through. If you're fortunate enough to still have your dad around, I know you're going to be taking care of him for Father's Day. And if he's a veteran, why not take a minute to not only thank him for his service and the way he risked his life for you, but find out if he has a story or two to share that maybe he hasn't opened up about before. The story we're going to hear today is one that could not be told for nearly a quarter century after World War II, simply because our government wasn't sure if the secret code we're going to be talking about might need to be employed again if we ended up in another large-scale conflict. It wasn't until 1968 that the Department of Defense declassified the unbroken code used by Marines of Navajo descent to fluster the Japanese in the Pacific. Not until December of 2000 did President George W. Bush honor the 29 original Navajo code talkers with the Congressional Gold Medal. The rest of the code talkers that followed beyond those original 29, they received the Silver Medal. And in the last 10 or 15 years, quite a bit of information has filtered out. One big attention getter was the major motion picture Wind Talkers in 2002. It didn't get all the best reviews, but Wind Talkers did expose a whole bunch of people to the heroic work of the Code Talkers. And I think a bit of that trailer from that film might give you a hint as to what we're going to be discussing with one of the few surviving Code Talkers today.
The Japanese have pretty much busted every code we've thrown at them. The Corps developed the new code based on the Navajo language. You're to pair with a code talker. Your job is to keep him alive so he can do his job.
I'm Ben Yazzie. It takes me 2.5 minutes to do what used to take an hour.
Orders finally came through. We ship out tomorrow morning.
You see any combat, Yazzie? Looking forward to getting into some.
Are you now?
Relay the coordinates!
Jump King, come!
You done good today, Ben.
You never called me that before.
Your mission is to protect the code at all costs. You understand me?
Yes, sir.
Again, that's a dramatization in the trailer for the 2002 movie Wind Talkers, but a lot of the things you heard there are going to tie directly into what we will hear from one of the surviving Navajo Code Talkers, Bill Toledo of Laguna, New Mexico. If you're listening today on the Rock of Talk, 95.9 and 1600 out in Albuquerque, or even if you've traveled through the Duke City like I did, maybe you've seen him in Old Town Albuquerque, just across the street from the historic San Felipe de Neri Church, at a card table with several relevant books laid out under a banner reading Navajo Code Talker. That is where I sat down with Bill Toledo. Every day there are all kinds of people from all over the country and all over the world that come to Old Town Albuquerque to get a taste of history. I don't know if they expect to get World War II history, but you're here to provide that. Why do you come out here and sit here with these books and tell your story? What do you get out of it? What's in it for you?
Well, I was told to tell the stories so people will know how we used our language in the World War II. And that's what they want to hear. And that's why, and then we also sell books so our kids can use the money to go to school, you know. That's why we raise money off of these books, and then we let the people know how the code was made and how it was used on the battlefield. That's why we come down here. Then we go to different towns here in New Mexico, and we do a lot of it here in Albuquerque. And then we go out of states to different places. Like we go out of Colorado, we go down to Texas and sub books down there and do the same thing too.
And for a lot of years, you couldn't even talk about what you did, could you?
We never talk about it for a long time. We just came home quietly. When we got discharged, we were told to keep our mouth shut. Never talk about it, you know, to our family, friends, and all that. So at that time, they told us it might be used again. So I think we were having a little problem with Russia at that time, and I thought that we might use that again. So that's why we kept our mouth shut for about 40 years. Nobody knew about how we did with our language, you know. And then when they declassified the code, and then they ran up all the code talkers, whatever they were, and we have a big reunion down in Phoenix. And then they put it in the paper, and that's just how they found out people. The people found out how we use our language in the war, you know.
And now there's all these books about it. There have been movies about it. What's that been like for you? Something that you had to hold inside and keep a secret, and then all of a sudden it's made you a bit of a celebrity.
Yeah, that's what happened. And when we became known, then everybody wanted to talk to you, you know. We go to make presentations at school, all the way from elementary, high school, university. So we go to different states, you know, and different cities, you know, and make presentation. And then we go on the reservation, talk to these Navajo kids, you know, on the reservation, make presentation on the code, you know, how we use our language in the war, you know. So we became well-known, you know. That's why we get all this requests, you know. Every time they want to hear from the Navajo code talker, you know, they know where we're at.
Yeah, you're right out here in Plaza Don Luis here in Old Town Albuquerque, and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of interesting people today. Some of the questions I have for you, first of all, let's start early on. What was it like growing up in the Navajo Reservation in northern New Mexico?
At home, in those times before the war, we didn't have no automobile. I think there was only two people that had automobiles, and the rest of us, we just traveled a wagon, you know. We had some school nearby where I went to school, you know, kindergarten, elementary, and then about 60 miles west of Torreon, that's where I grew up, eastern end of the Navajo Reservation. I went to school, it's Crown Point, New Mexico, it's a government boarding school. That's where I went to school. And at home, we have a lot of sheep. So I was one of the take care of the sheep, you know, during that time, and all I see is when all that herding sheep, you know, I see airplane going by way up there, you know. I would see very, very few automobiles being driven around the area, you know, and Now I travel by airplane, you know, and I go all over the city, all over the country.
Times have changed. You're talking about school. Now, in school, did you guys do anything in the Navajo language or all in English, or how did that work?
We used to get punished for...
You're talking about school. Now, in school, did you guys do anything in the Navajo language or all in English, or how did that work?
We used to get punished for talking our language in the government school, you know. And they don't want us to talk Navajo in school. So when they catch us talking Navajo, and then they sometimes they wash our mouth with the laundry soap to keep us, to shut us up, you know. And then when the war broke out, and then they came to you and said, "We want to use your language as a code," you know. Yeah. So that's what happened.
Well, speaking of the war breaking out, I like to ask every veteran about December 7th. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I was at Crown Point boarding school when we heard. Well, it was on Sunday when we heard the message that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was at the time. But Monday morning, a teacher showed us on the map, you know, where Pearl Harbor was located, Hawaii was located. That's how we found out, you know. And then from then on, you know, we have our old radio at home. We listened to that, you know, how the war was progressing, you know. And then one day, I was in school when one Navajo, he was already in the Marine Corps. He came to our school. He was out recruiting. He came to our school and wanted to talk to all the 16-year-old that are in good physical shape, you know, and speak English real fluently, talk real good in Navajo. And he wanted to talk to all these kids, you know, in good health. So, he talked to us for about 45 minutes, talking about marine life, you know. Later on, we found out that he was one of the co-talker that was trained. This first group that was trained, that was recruited, they made the code already. And they were out recruiting, you know, some more Navajos to go into the Marine Corps. And that's why he came to our school. So three of us from home and two from around Crown Point area, we got together. We talked about joining the Marines. So after we decided to join, then we told this young Marine, his name was Johnny Manolito. He was wearing Marine blues, you know, everything was shining. It looked real sharp, you know, and we wanted to be like him. So that's why... they had told us that boot camp was kind of tough, you know. But we all decided to see if we can make it through, you know. So we told him, Johnny, that we wanted to join the Marines.
So that was way back in 1942, and that's how Bill Toledo's World War II journey started. Went from tending sheep on the Navajo Reservation to risking his life and using his native language to save lives. We're going to explore more of Bill's story when we come back, from those moments he can laugh about now to the ones that left him suffering flashbacks for decades. If you'd like to learn more about the Navajo Code Talkers and their unique history, go to NavajoCodeTalkers.org. That's NavajoCodeTalkers.org. I also have quite a bit of information linked at hometownheroesradio.com and, of course, on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you can find some photos of our guest, Bill Toledo. Bill had a couple of relatives who joined the Marines with him in 1942, and one of them had a very clever way of meeting the minimum weight requirement. We'll catch that story as well when Hometown Heroes continues right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on the Navajo Code Talkers. You know, we've had veterans on the program in the past who worked with the Code Talkers in the Marine Corps in the Pacific, but we've never had a chance to listen to an actual Code Talker himself. Thanks to Bill Toledo of Laguna, New Mexico, we're getting that firsthand account today. One of the links I have for you at hometownheroesradio.com is to a book called Warriors, Navajo Code Talkers. It features photos of individual code talkers with short accounts of their contributions during the war. You'll find Bill Toledo on one page, and on the opposite page, his cousin, Preston Toledo, who he'll tell us a funny story about in a moment. Bill told us how a Navajo Marine came to the boarding school where he was, looking sharp in those dress blues. Bill wanted to be just like that Marine named Johnny. So he and a few friends decided to enlist, and that prompted, of course, another move.
So he sent us to another school, Fort Wingate Boarding School, about 12 miles east of Gallup, New Mexico. So he took our health. We all passed except one of the guys and didn't pass. His name was Preston Toledo, who was my cousin. He said, "Come on, guys," he said, "think of something." He said, I don't want to go back to school." He said, "I want to go with you guys. Think of something." But the recruiter said, "After lunch, I want to wait you guys again," he said. So Preston, we started teasing him. We told him that he should put some rocks in his pocket or some sand, you know, so he can pass his weight. And I said, "Don't tease me." He said, I want to go with you guys. And we ate lunch, and coming back, I had an uncle too. His name is Frank. Frank told Preston, he said, "Frank, Preston, you go run back to the dining room and drink a lot of water. You drink as much as you can stand it, because we were told that he's going to wait us again, you know." So he went and drank a lot of water. When he got weight again, he passed. Oh, he was happy, you know, and he served with the 6th Marine Division, Preston did. And I served with 3rd Marine Division, and Frank served with 5th Marine Division. We all went in together, went through boot camp together, and we went through code school together. And then after we graduated from code school, they have to test us. Marines didn't want us to write the code, 211 code, to put it on a piece of paper and carry it around on the battlefield, you know. They didn't want that way. They don't want it that way. So he told us that we were going to have to memorize it, the code, you know.
Because if it was written, then it would be susceptible to someone figuring it out, right?
Because when you get killed on the battlefield, the enemy will search you for information, you know, so... Then the Marines didn't want it that way, so we had to memorize it. So I passed the test, and I was assigned to 3rd Marine Division. So we all memorized it, you know, and it went real good on the battlefield. The way it worked was the commander of the unit on the battlefield will write a message in English, whatever the troop needs, you know. We sent the message. This English message, we used the code over the radio to another code talker. When he hears that code over the radio, he would transmit that back into English. The faster you receive it, the faster you send it, you save life. You know, so we saved a lot of lives of the Marines, and that's how it worked on the battlefield.
Do you remember, maybe not a specific message, but can you give us an example of the kind of information that you guys would transmit that way through the code? Mm-hmm. Was it troop movements or Japanese positions, or what kind of information?
Whatever the commander finds from the frontline troops, he will write it down on a notebook. Like we were trying to take a hill because there was a machine gun in the hill. Every time you approach the hill, it opened up on you with the machine gun. This commander will write a message, request artillery fire on hill 632 over. And then I had to send, there'll be a co-talker where the artillery is located on the beach about a mile away. And I'll call him that I'm sending, and send him a message. Request Joke Bel Totsosana Sinta Tsa Tasta Naki Asta Ta Naki Bastis. Request artillery fire on hill 632 over. And then I tell him that I translate this message. Code name for hill is Horse. Horse is sick. Code name for horse is sick. A hill. It's a Shin Da Tsa. Asta Ta Na Ki. Bahatis. That's a code name for a hill is sick horse. That's how we translate them, you know. Sometimes they're longer, you know, it's a different code. And the faster you send it, the faster you receive it. You save life.
And you know now that it was unbreakable, but at the time, were you ever afraid that someone would crack the code?
At that time, we were told that the Japanese was number one code breaker in the world. That's why we used this code, you know. There's a story about it in here where this Anglo man, he was a young boy, son of a Presbyterian missionary. They moved from the Midwest to Flagstaff, Arizona. They set up the church there on the west end of the Navajo Reservation. So every Sunday, these Navajos in that area, they come.
They would come to the church service, and before long, the young boy was translating Navajo for his parents, the missionaries. At this point in our interview, Bill kept elaborating on this story about the origins of the Code Talkers, but he also had an entire bus full of European tourists debark right in front of his tent. They were very interested in what he was up to there, so I stopped recording so he could sign some books for them. I can, however, pass on the rest of that story before we get back to Bill's words. The young missionary kid in question was named Philip Johnston. He was speaking Navajo by the age of 5, and that's when he started translating for his parents. What I'm sharing with you here comes from Bill Toledo's account, as well as the official file on origins of the Navajo Code Talkers on the National Security Agency's website. Chuckle all you want there at the NSA reference, but it does paint a very vivid picture of what took place before Bill Toledo and so many other Code Talkers got involved. And without Philip Johnston's persistence, it never would have happened. I'm going to read to you now from that NSA account because I think it adds a whole lot of perspective to our first-person account from Bill Toledo. Here's what it says about Philip Johnston. By age 9, when most boys his age were riding bikes and trading baseball cards, he had served as an interpreter for a Navajo delegation sent to Washington, D.C. to lobby for Indian rights. He had no way of knowing it at the time, but his affinity for and mastery of the Navajo tongue would one day help save the lives of countless United States Marines. In time, Johnston would leave the American Southwest and the people he loved to serve in World War I. After World War I, he would earn his civil engineering degree at the University of Southern California.
December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, found Johnston hard at work as an engineer for the city of Los Angeles. At the time, Johnston was in his 50s and well beyond the grasp of his local draft board. However, his experiences on the battlefields of Europe in an earlier time motivated him to try to put into action a plan that he was sure could help the war effort. Johnston's hope was to help the Marine Corps protect their communications so well that every Marine who wore the uniform would be provided a huge advantage in combat. His idea revolved around a code, but unlike many coding systems, this code was not dependent on a complicated machine or a series of numbers or ciphers. Rather, the heart of his proposal rested on the language of the Navajo Indians. He was convinced that, used properly, the Navajo dialect would provide unprecedented security to those who would need it most. All he needed was a chance to prove it. Johnston's initial efforts to convince the Marines of the worth of his project were less than successful. The Corps had serious doubts. Native Americans, particularly the Choctaw, had been used as code talkers in World War I with positive results. However, it was no secret that after 1918, any number of German nationals had visited the United States with the expressed purpose of learning the languages of American Indian tribes. Most assumed that the Third Reich would share its knowledge of these American Indian languages with its Axis partners. For this reason, many viewed the notion of using these languages to protect military communications as an idea whose time had long passed. But Johnston persisted in his efforts. He believed, with good reason, that the Navajo language was unique. The tribe came from a remote region, and only a handful of non-Navajos had any knowledge of the language. Despite the prevailing wisdom of the time, the Marine Corps finally agreed to host a test of Johnston's proposed system at Camp Elliott near San Diego. At the conclusion of the trial run, everyone agreed that the results had been impressive. The Navajos involved in the demonstration had clearly shown that they could take messages from a variety of sources in English, translate and transmit them in Navajo, and then send them back in English. Due to the success of that trial run, those who had witnessed the testing initially lobbied for the recruitment and training of over 200 code talkers. In the end, a total of only 30 men would be approved for the first group. However, by VJ Day, over 400 Navajos would work in the program. Isn't this fascinating? It continues here. In May of 1942, with the imprimatur of the Navajo Tribal Council, formal recruiting efforts began at Winslow Rock, Arizona, the capital of the Navajo Nation. Philip Johnston, despite his age, expressed a desire to be involved in the recruiting and training of the men. After some thought, the Corps agreed to grant him a waiver and allowed him to enlist in the Marine Corps at the rank of Staff Sergeant. Johnston would only remain in uniform for a short time, but he would always have the satisfaction of knowing he had been the driving force behind a program that would benefit the Corps for years to come. Shortly after the initial recruit training at the San Diego Depot, the group was sent to Camp Pendleton for training in standard radio procedures. After their primary skills had been honed, Johnston and his compatriots began putting into place the system that would protect critical Marine battlefield communications for the duration of the war. At first glance, it would seem that the language itself would be enough to provide the required level of security. However, the Marine Corps realized they could make the system virtually unbreakable by further encoding the language through word substitution. In addition, because the Navajo language contained no words to describe the modern implements of war, the trainees took familiar words from their language and applied them to items such as tanks, which were turtles, and planes, birds. Finally, in order to protect the code from falling into enemy hands, the aforementioned system was committed to memory. This intense training regimen achieved the desired goal of making the code undecipherable to everyone but the code talkers, men like Bill Toledo. And under the heading "From Guadalcanal to Okinawa," this official history continues. The work of the men of the Marine Corps in its conquering of the strategic islands and atolls of the South Pacific is one of the great success stories of modern warfare. Many were responsible for their success, but it cannot be denied that the code talkers played a critical role. Wherever they were employed, whether it was on Saipan or Tarawa, Peleliu or Guam, they performed brilliantly. On Iwo Jima, the Marines fought an entrenched enemy in caves and redoubts from one end of the island to the other. In many cases, the enemy could only be dislodged through fierce hand-to-hand combat followed up by grenades and flamethrowers. When the battle began, 20,000 Japanese troops occupied the island. 36 days later, at battle's end, only 1,083 members of the Imperial Army were left. In this kind of environment, any advantage one could gain over the enemy was welcomed. In this regard, the code talkers and their ability to provide secure communications
were a godsend. The record shows that despite the horrific conditions previously described, during the first 48 hours on Iwo Jima, six code talkers working 24-hour shifts sent and received over 800 messages, all without error. Major Howard, the 5th Marine Division signal officer, stated succinctly that were it not for the Navajos, the Marines would have never taken the island. The work of the Navajos on Iwo Jima was impressive, but the larger point is that wherever they did their work, they provided an indispensable advantage to those who wore the globe and anchor. At war's end, Philip Johnston, ever the believer in the code talkers' abilities, sought to make the program permanent, but was ultimately turned down. Instead, like millions of other American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, the Navajo code talkers returned to their homes and their families. Of the 400 or so code talkers who fought on the unforgiving battlefields of the South Pacific, 13 never returned. Those who lived would have the privilege of knowing that they played an indispensable role in protecting critical information from the enemy and in saving countless lives. Even today, when communications circle the globe and the universe at lightning speed, the code talkers' accomplishments serve as an outstanding example of what can happen when cryptologic brilliance is combined with linguistic expertise and dedication to duty. A whole lot of words that pretty much match up with everything Bill Toledo said. The faster they transmit the message and receive it, the more lives they save. Again, that was from the official NSA history on the origins of the Navajo code talkers. And now that we have that big picture in view, let's zoom back in on the personal experience of a teenager plucked from the reservation and sent to a war zone, Bill Toledo. I know Bougainville was your first action, but just getting there, I bet you'd never been on a ship before. That had to be quite a journey for you.
That's right, yeah. After we were assigned to 3rd Marine Division, they were ready to move out at Camp Pendleton. I was told, they were told not to ask questions. I met these 3rd Marine Division members there. They were ready to move out. So that's where I joined them. And they were whispering behind me where I was sitting. I was wondering why they were whispering, you know. And I finally caught on to what they were saying. This Indian that has joined us is going to be a Japanese interpreter. That's why they were whispering to each other, you know. So I got to meet them, this bunch there, and spent the night there. And the next day, we were ready to move out. We moved on to San Diego Harbor, where we boarded ship. Great big troop ship called Mount Vernon. Before we boarded the ship, we had lunch. After we set sailing, some of these guys were hanging over the rail, you know. And I just wonder why they were doing that. Here, I guess they were throwing up, you know. I got seasick already. Because after that lunch, you know, so that's what happened. Then we were told that we're heading for New Zealand. So when we got down to Equator, they told us to put on our wintergreen uniform and go topside and stand in the sun for 1 hour. Because the sun was straight up and it was hot. We were standing there in the sun for 1 hour. A lot of these guys, they fell over, you know, from the heat. That's how we were initiated, going crossing the equator. And then we went on down to New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand. They took us out about 20 miles out into the country where the camp was already set up. That's where we were going to do some training over there. The training mostly was hiking, you know, with a full combat pack, a bedding roll and ration and hand grenade. And we have a rifle. Ammunition, water. So we hiked every day, 20 miles a day. So we were there all through the summer. When 1st Marine Division secures Guadalcanal, they move out, and then we move in. Because we were told we would be doing some jungle training there. Because the Japanese were really good at jungle warfare. So we wanted to learn something about this warfare in the jungle, you know, so that's where we move in.
So that was on Guadalcanal, still to come, combat situations and some pretty close calls. The rest of Code Talker Bill Toledo's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When you say the words hearing aid, people think of that big bulky banana behind the ear. when the reality is today's modern hearing aid is completely unnoticeable.
That's Nathan Lev from locally owned Sound Advice with some news worth hearing.
We have access to all the major manufacturers, all the different styles. We carry a product called Lyric, which is a very new type of technology, and it suits a particular individual that is not able to wear a traditional type of hearing device. The Lyric product is the future of hearing devices.
Sound Advice offers its patients the best possible care and new innovative products. Call today to schedule a free hearing test and consultation. 579-1310.
We're not high pressure in any way. We're patient advocates, and we want to find each individual the best possible solution for their scenario.
Call Sound Advice today at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, exploring the history of the Navajo Code Talkers today. There are a lot of resources out there, great books, documentaries, even a feature film with Nicolas Cage, but there's no substitute from hearing from one of the Code Talkers himself, and that's what we're getting from Bill Toledo. When we left off, he had been taken to Guadalcanal, where he and his fellow Code Talkers would receive additional training, and his initial taste of combat would be pretty close at hand.
They had this coconut grove away from the Henderson Field, where we had set up the camp. These Japanese had the air bases not too far from Guadalcanal. We started getting the air raid, you know, at night, strafing the airfield, Henderson Field. So we had our jungle training there all through the summer.
What was it like when you got to Bougainville? With all that training, did it really prepare you for what combat was really like, or was that another awakening for you?
Oh, Bougainville. When we landed, I was supposed to send a message, what's going on the beach, to the headquarters on the ship, to another code talker. I don't know why the general didn't let me do that, what's going on the beach, you know. So after that, we move into the jungle. It rained a lot on Bougainville. When you dig a foxhole about that deep, you know, the water will come go into the foxhole. Makes you feel like you're laying in the bathtub. And get all wet, you know. And we have password at night. Every night we have password. Mostly some famous boxer, famous baseball player or basketball player. So every evening we have a new password. So the Japanese, they move around at night, you know. And anybody comes to your foxhole, you have to challenge them. Who goes there, you know? If he doesn't answer with the password, and you can get rid of them, you know. As we were moving into the jungle, ahead of, behind the frontline troop, there was a Marine, I guess one of the frontline troop, was walking behind us, and he was supposed to be with the other group in front, and I guess he mistaked me for the Japanese. He poked me with a rifle in the back and told me to raise my hand and turn me in to the commander. Told the commander that I found this Japanese walking with you guys. What shall I do with him? Shall I go ahead and shoot him, you know? And then the commander said, what are you doing back here? He said, you're supposed to be out in front with his front line troop. Get your butt back in there, you know, and let him go. He's one of our men, you know. So he let me go. And without me knowing, I was assigned this one Marine. He was a takes care of the coat. We share foxhole together. He was assigned to me as my bodyguard without me knowing it, you know. So.
And that tells you the work you were doing with that code must have been pretty important for them to give you a bodyguard, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we memorized the code, and it's all in our head, you know, that's why.
So what was that bodyguard going to do if you guys were captured together?
I found out later on from another code talker that they had orders. Somebody told him that when we get captured like that, the bodyguard will shoot you, you know, get rid of you because you memorized the code, you know, to protect the code and himself, too. That's what this one code talker told me. So if I knew about it, I don't know how I would have felt.
And this is decades after the war that you find this out. So how did you feel about it when you found out?
This happened something like 43 years after the war. But I went to see him, my bodyguard, you know, in California. One day we have this after the war. We used to get together, all the communication sectors I used to serve with. We go to a different city and have a reunion, you know. This one was in San Francisco. When he asked me, he said, "Did you know that I was a bodyguard?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." So that's when I found out. Long time after the war.
Did that make you a little emotional or rock your world a little bit to find out that he had had those orders?
Yeah, after that. But he didn't tell me that he would shoot me, you know. This came from another code talker. That's when he told me. And then later on, I found out that he was supposed to shoot me, kill me. And then that's when I started thinking about it. So I wonder how I would have felt, you know.
Are you glad you didn't know at the time?
Yeah, I was glad I didn't know at the time.
I don't blame you. And that, by the way, is one of the central plot points to the Wind Talkers movie. The Nicolas Cage character is tasked with protecting the code at all costs. Bill's bodyguard was too, but unlike the code talkers in the movie, Bill was not aware of this arrangement. And as you heard, he's thankful for that. But Bill, I know there were some other situations you encountered in which that danger was pretty evident.
Another close call you had was on Guam, where you're running a message, and this wasn't something you usually did, carry a message, but they ask you to be a messenger. And tell me about what you had to do and what happened.
Oh, that one, what happened was we're about halfway up the mountain when we were spending the night up there. And that night we were attacked. Must have been about middle of the night we were attacked by the Japanese Banzai attack, they call it. Because when they attack like that, you know, they holler like, "Banzai, Banzai," you know. There was only somewhere around about 20 of them. It sounded like they were over 100 hollering, "Banzai," you know. So when the frontline troop opened up on them, they got rid of them. They destroyed our radio and they were throwing hand grenades, you know, all that. They destroyed our radio and telephone. So I was supposed to be used as a runner. The next morning, one of the sergeant came over. He gave me a note. He said, "Take this note down to the beach where the regimental headquarters, so we can have another radio and telephone, you know." So he was a sergeant. I was only a PSC, so on the double, he told me. So I took off. I was supposed to let the my bodyguard know about it, you know. So I just went and took off, delivered the message. So we got another radio and telephone.
But you came to a muddy area that you had to cross, and all of a sudden bullets started flying?
Oh, yeah. And I came to a truck where they were loading some dead Marines, you know. They were taking them off the hill on the stretchers with the rope on, you know, bringing them down to the where the truck is. And then they put them in the truck, and like a pile of log in there, you know. And some of those Marines that got killed. When I got into the clear there, I heard bullets going by, you know, and I started running. Before I started to move, you know, there was a bunch of Marines on the other side against the hill, and they were hollering at me, you know, and they were saying something, but I couldn't understand what they were hollering about. So I just went on and took off, just walking, you know, and then pretty soon I heard a bullet going by. I started running, you know, zigzagging like that, and I fall in the muddy road and get up. And here there was a sniper up in the canyon, way up on top. I guess he saw me going down there. He was shooting at me, and there was a Marine up at the top. This sniper was right below him. He came out of his hiding place and started shooting at me, and then this Marine saw him there, he shot him. And then he fell down into the canyon, you know, way down there. And then I started walking. I mean, I kept running over there and zigzagging all the way. And then when I got over there, close to these guys, one of the Marines came over, run over to me, and said, "Hey, Chief, where did you play football, you know?" And then he was telling me about the sniper. And that's why they were all bunched up over there, because he's been picking off these Marines that were going by. So I delivered the message, and we got our radio and telephone.
He brought up football because he was impressed with your moves, dodging all those bullets, huh?
Yeah.
But they came pretty close, too? One of them got a piece of your clothing?
Yeah. Well, one of them, my jacket on here, she put a little hole there.
Mm-hmm. If that Marine hadn't shot that Japanese sniper, do you think you would have made it through there?
You mean me?
Yeah.
I guess while I was still out there, down there, that's when he shot him, killed him.
So if he hadn't shot him, that sniper would have had a few more shots at you.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I don't know, I was a target,
When it comes to your role as a code talker, and there were more than 400 of you, and now there are fewer than 50 left alive, so you're one of the only ones that can tell this story and keep this history alive. What is important to you for us to know? What do you want us to remember?
There's some others, the code talkers are doing that too, yeah. Tell their stories and all.
So why is that important? Why do you do it?
Well, that's what these people that make requests, they want to hear stories about how we use the language on the battlefield. Because they had heard it helped win the war. That's the main reason that they want how we use the code on the battlefield.
Yeah, and I can tell it's important to you to keep that history alive and let people know about the men like you, especially those 13 who died during World War II. And, of course, the man who envisioned it all, Philip Johnston. I want to make sure to say thank you, Bill. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about the unique way that you served our country. And another thing I like to ask veterans who have a whole lot of decades to reflect back upon is, what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I was very lucky to help put the story across, to people, so they know what we did with our language, and that's the reason I'm kind of glad that I did this. I did it,
You survived those close calls you've talked to us about. You also were there the first day of the Battle of Iwo Jima. Your cousin was there, too. You guys actually met up there on Iwo. There's a lot of things that you lived through. Did you ever feel like somebody was looking out for you, or that you were fortunate to survive in as good a shape as you did?
After the war, I came back. I was at home, I had this dream about the war, that sometimes, what did they call that?
Flashback?
Yeah, flashback, that's what I get. And I suffered that for a long time, until finally it got so bad that I had to get treatment from my people, my medicine man, to treat me for that flashback, and then you went away, and I was cured.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you shared that with us, because I know you're not alone in having those haunting dreams and flashbacks. So many of the veterans I've interviewed over the years have experienced that also, and I don't want the rest of us to be ignorant to that burden that you carried and some still carry today. I've heard a lot of things on Hometown Heroes over the years, but I have never heard anyone sing the Marine Corps hymn in Navajo. I understand that's your specialty, Bill. Would you do that for us? I know you're proud to claim the title of United States Marine. There you have it. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, but from the native tongue of a Navajo code talker, Bill Toledo of Laguna, New Mexico. I know I sure learned a lot. Hope you did too, and I hope you'll join us again next time. All those links that I've referenced today are available at hometownheroesradio.com. You'll find some photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I can't say it in Navajo, but I'll give it to you in plain English one more time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.